Good to see you all this morning.
Okay, we'll take just another little quick side trip this morning and look at a church organization that, I don't know, maybe you know something about, maybe not. First Church of Christ Scientist. Let's see. Here we go. And really, kind of some short explanation here on this group. In part, I brought it up just because of the name. I've been asked before, that Church of Christ, that's like you too, isn't it? Well, no. Where are they very much like what you believe? No, like not at all. I mean, like there's like nothing about this group that we would find any similarity with. And so I just thought it might be interesting for us to spend a few minutes to know a few things about this group right here. Now, you may have walked through town somewhere. You don't see this as much as you used to. And some little old storefront in town, usually just a very small spot, just a window front, and they have some Bibles and books. First Church of Christ Scientist reading room. Have you ever seen those? I mean, you don't see that as much anymore. It used to be in any little old podunk town anywhere you went, you'd see a reading room of the Church of Christ Scientist. In Henderson, there's one. Yeah, and there is in somewhere around Asheville here, too. Not as many as there used to be, though, because they have decreased in number, in size, and in revenues a lot, and they've had to make a lot of cutting back as time has gone on. In fact, this could very well be one of those groups that just kind of goes extinct here before so long. Read somewhere that they have about 85,000 adherence, you know, to this group, this religion. And so that's pretty small. And really, kind of where this came about was, in the late 1800s. And the reason why I brought that up, because we're still in that period of time of the late 1800s. And so here was a group that kind of came about by the teaching and the prophecies of Mary Baker Eddy. Now, maybe you've heard that name before. I mean, there's some books. You can pretty readily still buy books that were written by her that would kind of explain her ideas on faith and maybe some of the prophecies that she has received and some things like that. And again, you don't see those as much as you did a few years ago, but still, it's just kind of interesting to know some things about that group. Now, you know, from the inception of this group, the focus of their doctrine comes from the writings of Mary Baker Eddy. In fact, it's in a very prevalent and prominent way. They're quite proud of the fact that Mary Baker Eddy was their first pastor and, you know, was the first leader of their group. So again, we go back to 1879 when the group was founded in a more formal way, when their board of directors... They never even claimed to have elders or a presbytery or anything like that. They just have a board of directors, you know, that made some decisions for the church and ordained Mary Baker Eddy as their first pastor. And so I happen to have a church manual of the first Church of Christ Scientist in Boston, Massachusetts, by Mary Baker Eddy, of course. So who else would it be written by? And this is a 1924 edition. It's kind of interesting, a little book, just to kind of go through. The pages are about to fall out of this one here, but it just goes through all of the pertinent stuff that the church must know, you know, about who is the president and of the church, how do you elect a clerk and treasurer, who are the readers for the church, those who have the official responsibility of doing the reading in the church, and how to conduct church business. That's what's in their church, you know, discipline book or church manual. And other important stuff about the mother church, as they call it. You know, the first Church of Christ Scientist is the mother church of all churches, is the way they would look at it. And so everything in here with regard to how a church is supposed to function and be run is included in here. And It's kind of interesting to read. It's mostly sickening to read, really. I mean, that people would look at this as being, well, this is what religion is supposed to be. I mean, the words of Mary Baker Eddy is their doctrine. Oh, they claim to use the Bible. And in their readings, I mean, when their church assembly takes place, it is mainly just reading that takes place. They will read some from the Bible, and then they will read from the prophecies of Mary Baker Eddy. And that's their doctrine. I mean, that's what they're going to read. If you could bear with me to read some to you, you know, from their book right here. This gives a little history of how this came about. In the spring of 1879, a little band of earnest seekers after truth went into deliberations over forming a church without creeds. Well, I like that part. I mean, I love the way that sounds. And so a church without creeds to be called Church of Christ, Scientist. Scientist, where does that come from? They were members of evangelical churches and students of Mrs. Mary Baker Eddy in Christian Science and were known as Christian Scientists. At the meeting of the Christian Scientist Association, April 19, 1879, on motion of Mrs. Eddy, it was voted to organize a church designed to commemorate the Word and the works of our Master, which should reinstate primitive Christianity and its lost element of healing. Well, I mean, there's some points that are made here that make you think, hey, maybe they're looking for truth. You know, they want to establish a church that would identify the Master, speaking of Jesus. And so there seems to be some good elements to that. Well, except the only problem with that is he already established that church. You know, we don't have to establish another one. He's already done that. But anyway, this is what they're saying. And the other thing was, reinstate primitive Christianity and its lost element of healing. Hence the Scientist part in the title. Now they're very big on healing. Like, this is a major work of the church. And that to be a true adherent, you know, to this philosophy, you must believe in the healing power that comes from God. Okay, I mean, I get and I understand the point of faith and knowing and understanding the power God has to heal. But this becomes a very prominent part of their doctrine. You know, some questions get asked by some. Well, does the Christian Church Scientist believe, do those members go to the doctor or to the hospitals? You know, because there are some who believe so strongly in healing that, you know, maybe they don't go to the doctor when they're sick or go to the hospital when there's some catastrophic illness. But in their readings, as you kind of go through, like on the website and things like that, they don't say you can't do those things. They say each person has to make their own judgment whether they would choose to go to a doctor or not when they're sick or go to the hospital if there's catastrophic illness. And some of our members choose to do so. It says something like that. Of course, it very much infers that some choose not to do that. It is also what you would have to take from that. Reading a little farther, Mrs. Eddy was appointed on the committee to draft the tenets of the Mother Church, the chief cornerstone whereof that Christian Science, as taught and demonstrated by our Master, casts out error, heals the sick, and restores the lost Israel. For the stone which the builders rejected, the same is become the head of the corner. Okay, so they quote a little bit of scripture there. But in the bigger picture of some things that they say and they teach, the Church of Christ Scientist is the cornerstone of that which would represent Christ. Well, now here again. You know, there is no need for us to go out and invent a church that is the mother church that all should adhere to, and to bring about a doctrine that highlights the Master, because that's already been done. And it came from God. And so it's kind of bizarre to me that there are some here that are just so bold in what they're saying, even in their foundational notes, that they're saying, you know, I mean, what we have is obviously not enough. We need something more to establish the mother church and the tenets by which it will continue and how it will go forward. So the charter for the church was obtained June of 1879, and the same month, the members, 26 in number, extended a call to Mary Baker Eddy to become their pastor. Think of this thing about Mary Baker Eddy. I mean, have you noticed that she's a key player in this? She's in part of every meeting. She makes the first motion, we should start this church. And somehow or another, she gets ordained as the first pastor as well. She accepted the call and was ordained in 1881. Although walking through deep waters, the little church went steadily on, increasing in numbers, and at every epoch saying, "Hitherto hath the Lord helped us." So as they have seen some things happen and some growth takes place, they look at that as being, this is at the hand of God. Well, I think not. I mean, there are a lot of churches, the Catholic Church could say the same thing, and every church that's come after that, because they've seen some growth, you know, hitherto is the hand of God. We can see the hand of God in this. We need to be careful about that. I've heard brethren say that sometimes. And maybe even there's some point or purpose in saying that, well, we can see the hand of God in this, because here is something that's happened that's been good. The effects have been good. Surely it's by the hand of God. Well, it could be if it's according to His will. But I've heard that said even by some brethren who have done some things and have claimed that it came by the hand of God that I feel quite confident is not following the pattern that's here. So we need to be real, real careful when we see something that happens that we determine that this has got to be by the hand of God. When it doesn't follow the pattern of God, it can't be by the hand of God. It may be from someone's hand, but it's not from God's. And we need to be careful to be able to make that distinction. Because here is another religious group that is formed. They have their board of directors. They have their first ordained pastor and prophet, who's going to be a prolific writer who publishes many books, you know, that promote the mother church, you know, the cornerstone of Christianity, that does in practice just basically nothing that comes from this book. Now they follow the tenets of books like this, but in the reading that I was able to do, hardly ever is there any kind of reference to anything that comes from this book. And at times when there is a reference to it, it's misapplied. And so I guess it's a warning to us to again be able to see and to recognize that just because someone calls themselves a church, and just because they say we see the hand of God in what we're doing, we need to be able to stand back and identify what is scriptural, what is to the pattern of Scripture, and what is not. Let me read you a couple of this little things here. Qualifications for membership, First Church of Christ Scientist. Believe in Christian Science, Section 1. To become a member of the Mother Church, the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston, Massachusetts, the applicant must be a believer in the doctrines of Christian Science according to the platform and teaching contained in the Christian Science textbook, Science and Health with the Key to the Scriptures, by Reverend Mary Baker Eddy. The Bible, together with Science and Health and other works by Mrs. Eddy, shall be his only textbooks for self-instruction in Christian Science and for teaching and practicing metaphysical healing. I just find that amazing. I mean, so very boldly proclaiming that, okay, to be a part of this church right here, basically what it's saying is you need to read and understand and follow the textbook written by Mary Baker Eddy. Oh yeah, the Bible together with Science and Health is a good thing to do too. You know, it's almost like it's just an after. Well, you better put the Bible in there somewhere. You know, and so this is, to me, is one of the most blatant religions that is out there that calls themselves a Christian religion that seemingly almost forgets to even acknowledge Christ. And so that's pretty bold. Let's see, maybe another. What else did I mark here? Sunday School, Section 1. Pupils may be received in the Sunday school classes of any Church of Christ Scientist up to the age of 20 years, and by transfer from another Church of Christ Scientist up to that age, but no pupil shall remain in the Sunday school of any Church of Christ Scientist after reaching the age of 20. none except the officers, teachers, pupils should attend the Sunday school exercises. Sorry, you all have to leave. You're all too old. You know, so you come to age 20, you don't go to Sunday school, or as they call it, you know, anymore. That's just for the kids. And so I'm not exactly sure what the adults do. I mean, and I don't fully understand all that they say or do, but I think when they have their assembly, which may not even be every Sunday, it's just for a few moments of reading from the books of, what's her name? Mary Baker Eddy, and maybe a passage from the Bible, and that's their assembly. They don't take the Lord's Supper. They don't do any of the, as they say, the sacraments. They find those sacraments to be unnecessary in what they do. Anyway, I had some other things marked, but I think we're probably getting the point here, aren't we?
Yes.
Whew, hands, Ed. Oh, let me read something else to you. Good point here. Order of exercises for the Sunday school of the Mother Church and branch churches. Call to order by the superintendent. A hymn. Subject of the lesson announced. Golden text repeated by the children. Responsive reading takes place. A silent prayer, followed by the audible repetition of the Lord's Prayer in unison. Instruction in class in accordance with Section 2 and Section 3 of Article 20 of the Manual of the Mother Church. Entire school reassembles. Hymn. Science statements, or a scientific statement of being read by the superintendent, school dismissed. That's the order of Sunday school. Well, no. I mean, like now, on Wednesday night, she would be one of the first, yes. On Wednesday night, we talked about Seventh-day Adventists. And we see the power and influence of Ellen White. Now, there were a couple of men that were with her as that Seventh-day Adventist group was kind of formed, but they died. And so she kind of became the matriarch of the Seventh-day Adventist, you know, movement. And she was a prolific writer and prophet, just like Mary Baker Eddy. You know, Eddy just came along, you know, 20 years later or something like that. So that would be two of the most prominent and prevalent women, you know, in a religious movement that I see in that time. Of course, now, so it's not as unusual. But that would have been kind of, you know, earth-shaking in that time, late 1800s. Yeah. Well, interesting. I mean, bizarre. Sad. Just very sad, you know, that at where some things have come to here. You know, if you've ever been in downtown Boston, you walk around some of the old town downtown Boston. Well, I say old town. There's a lot of new town built around the old town. You can't help but walk by this building. And this is the original mother church of the Church of Christ Scientists that was built in Boston. This right here is the original. Things must have went well because they added on. Can you notice this part back here? You know, I mean, things must have been going well there for a while. And, I mean, it's a huge building. That's why I say if you walk around some of the streets of downtown, you can't hardly miss, you know, in a very prominent way in the signs, Church of Christ Scientists, Boston, Massachusetts. They seem to be just as proud as Boston, Massachusetts as their name because it always seems to kind of say that. And this is kind of looking from the side view, looking up this reflecting pond. Some of these other buildings, you know, along here belong to Church of Christ Scientists, and this big administrative building over here, which I was reading the other night, you know, is mostly rented out space now. I mean, they have laid off all but about 85 of their full-time workers because, you know, the group is shrunk so much, you know, in size and revenues. But they must be doing pretty good in real estate. You know, I mean, that part's going on. That's right. Okay. So it was a faith issue.
Yeah. So therefore, this is your punishment, or this is what's happening to you because of your lack of faith. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that my friend's dad passed away early when he was in his early 50s. His mother, several years later, remarried. She got sick and had pneumonia. This is about 20 years later. She passed away. And he happened to die a few years ago with a heart attack. And when he got sick, they wouldn't go to the doctor. The only time you go to the doctor is if, for the true believer, let's say, if you were deathly ill, cancer,
catastrophic. Now, I have wondered, and I don't know this, but I have wondered, you know, Seventh-day Adventist was 20 years or so ahead of this, and of course they placed a lot of emphasis on, you know, eating well, good health, you know, taking care of yourself, and that was a part of their faith. If this was, you know, influenced by the SDA, I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I see. Right. And I did read a little bit about, you know, calling, you know, the church, those from the mother church, to pray for those with illness and stuff like that. And so I really got that impression. But in some things that I read, like online and stuff like that, you know, they, as is often the case in any of these online things that you look at, they don't always get to the bottom line of what their faith is. You know, Linda, then you're on. Oh, wow.
To advance financially.
Wow.
And then she married, and she was the first to be in the church, and then the man, and then they had a child, and so they both had to work, but the church sent them to the place for the jobs. The church put them in.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And
becomes very controlling.
And the one in the daycare was also spying on all the parents that had the children there. If they mentioned that they weren't too sure about something in the church, somebody would tell it to the church.
Wow.
Right. And all that sort of thing.
while.
So they finally and it had to be real quiet talking to each other because a lot of places they had
It's spies.
They had spies and they had what do you call it, recording.
Yeah.
You know, so it had to be real careful.
Oh, wow.
And so they planned it out and they took that child you know, spread along.
Yeah.
I mean, they had it.
Yeah.
But here's the thing about it. Gary is making the point that, you know, if your faith is not strong enough, you're going to get sick. That tells me that none of their faith is strong enough because they all die.
Eventually,
they're all going to die.
Yeah. You think we could see a pattern here, you know? But I don't know. I mean, just right. Well, just wanted to spend a few minutes just looking at this little group. And we're not gonna, like I said before, we're not looking at every little group and organization out there, but because of the name and some things like that, I thought we need to spend a minute on this. We filled up our page on Wednesday night, Seventh-day Adventist kind of being on the bottom. You know, the more classical Reformed churches, we already covered all of those. We're going on to our second page. We add First Church of Christ Scientists. We'll go ahead and put that in there. And then in our outline, kind of takes us to another group that in some ways has some similarities to both some things we saw with SDA, some things that we see with Christian Church Scientists, you know, as we come into the Jehovah's Witness. And that's a group that kind of got started here about that same time. And I wonder, again, if that's why there are some similarities because of just things that were being talked about in those days. You know, just like with the Christian Church Scientists, there would be those among the Jehovah's Witnesses that would not do some things medically, you know, believing that it would be some indication of lack of faith, you know, and so, you know, that and this is a group that's starting about that time. Let's just think here a little bit about where this kind of came from. So we introduce a guy named Charles Taze Russell. He's not actually the founder of Jehovah's Witnesses. But he had a lot to do with getting the ball rolling that led to the group being called Jehovah's Witnesses after his death. And so he was, as some would say, he was an American Christian minister. I say Christian, you know, in the fact that he was a Protestant, he wasn't Catholic. I know Catholic calls themselves Christians too, but there is some distinction there. And what he was more of a founder of was a group called Bible Study Movement. And the idea of the group, I certainly wouldn't have an objection to, was that we need to study the Bible more. Well, yes, I agree with that. You know, that's a good thing. But again, kind of like some others that we've talked about in some of these recent movements, he becomes infatuated with the second advent of Christ, with the coming of Christ, and believes that it's imminent. I mean, just like in the beginning of, you know, SDA and some of these other groups we've looked at, I mean, in the late 1800s, I mean, this was the rage. I mean, this was just a big part of teaching that was going on in a lot of groups, you know, that the second coming of Christ is here. It's happening anytime. And you had those like Russell who started making some predictions as to when that was going to happen. It's going to, you know, it's imminent. It's going to happen just really soon. Well, there were some other groups that also kind of came out of his teaching. He didn't necessarily start these groups, but these were sort of, you know, based on the idea of Bible study movement, you know, the Pastoral Bible Institute. There are these schools that got started with, supposedly, with an emphasis on Bible teaching as opposed to doctrine teaching of some of the, you know, they're not teaching a Catholic catechism. They're not teaching, you know, the doctrines of the Reformation churches, but these were supposedly just Bible institutes, Bible schools. You know, the Berean Bible Institute, Stand Fast Bible Students Association, you know, some of these different groups that kind of got going. But what came out of some of these groups, some of those who were followers in these groups, was a group that later became known as Jehovah's Witnesses. And again, many people kind of tie Russell in with the beginning of the Jehovah's Witnesses, but that group didn't really get organized until after he was dead. But it came out of some of the early teachings that he did, and most specifically, some of his writing, you know, is what led to this. Now, Jehovah's Witness was officially organized in 1931. Well, that's not that long ago. That's less than 100 years ago. You know, sometimes we think of some of these groups, you know, as being, you know, many, many years old. But now, I mean, really, the last three or four we've talked about are less than 200 years old. Now we're talking about one that's less than 100 years old, you know, in its organization. And so, some of the things here with regard to this movement of Jehovah's Witnesses. As we said, Russell was very much a writer. And one of his early publications in 1879, Under the Tower of Zion's Watchtower, sound familiar? And Herald of Christ's Presence. I'm confused if that's two separate writings or the same writing that came out under two different titles. I'm not sure which. But there was a lot of writing that he did in the late 1800s that when you kind of read a few excerpts from one into another, it sounds a whole lot the same. I think there was just a lot of rewriting what he had already said. And the purpose and the theme of a lot of what he said was just the same thing repeated over and over. I mean, it's just like if you get a hold of, you know, one of the Jehovah's Witnesses books. I've got several. They're all different titles, different color book. They used to give these things out, you know, pretty readily, or they want you to pay for it. They want you to pay a dollar for it or something like that. But I won't pay a nickel for it. But if they'll give me one, you know, I've taken some. And so, you know, got three or four of these, you know, that I've read bits and pieces from. They sort of all say the same thing. I mean, the thrust of what it's talking about is always the same thing, you know, that the end is coming soon. And that was what Russell was saying in the Zion's Watchtower, some of his early publications. It was filled with such things, you know, to lead people to believe that we were living in the last days. It's the day of the Lord, the end of the gospel age, that the dawn of the new age, you know, are all things that are just said and repeated in his writings of the late 1800s, or if you read any publication of the Watchtower Society today. You know, that's still the thrust of what they're saying. And there is just millions of copies of these publications that have been printed in 100 different languages around the world. They've been very prolific in their writing. That is their thrust. And really, that kind of came from Russell. I mean, that was how he started spreading, you know, his idea of what the gospel, you know, should be, or anything of that type. Let me read a couple of other things for you here. In our outline, in fact, you look in our outline page 81.
Let me pick up a couple of points here. We may have already mentioned these. Oh, here. Speaking about Russell, bottom of page 81. It was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that he predicted in 1872 the second coming of Christ and the millennium. Now, when we talk about the millennium, what is that referring to? Or what is he referring to? Yeah, thousand-year reign. This is going to become a big part of their teaching, that Christ is coming again and that He is going to establish His kingdom and that He is going to reign for 1,000 years here on earth. Okay, so this is just a very prominent part of their teaching. And so anyway, in 1878, he organized his followers as an independent church. His teachings were spread through the Watchtower, which Russell began to publish in 1879. In 1909, he moved his headquarters to Brooklyn Tabernacle in New York City. Their headquarters is still there in New York City. It says, Russell was involved in scandals which somewhat tarnished his reputation, but his sect nevertheless flourished. You know, that's kind of an interesting thing. I mean, this guy's reputation when it comes to honesty and some things like that, to say it was tarnished is probably being kind. I mean, he had a number of different schemes, which basically all seemed to be schemes to make money, like, you know, the miracle wheat seed, which was in, like, I'll say it was in 1909, that may not be right, but somewhere in that time when he was selling this miracle wheat seed. Okay, and I mean, it was a dollar for a bag, which was like a lot of money. But it would grow 5 times more than any wheat seed that you could buy anywhere else because this was a miracle wheat seed. Sold quite a bit of this. And you know, after a little time, there was some investigation made. A newspaper in New York City really kind of got on top of this after people were saying, this doesn't grow any better than the other wheat seed that I bought. Where's the miracle? You know, and they actually sued him. The newspaper did. And so, I mean, it took some time to kind of sort this out. You know, the federal government got involved, the agriculture department, you know, doing tests, you know, of the miracle seed versus other seed, and basically said, I mean, the government was saying, well, this seed doesn't grow any more than what this other. In fact, it may even be deficient to what this other seed you can buy. And so the newspaper actually won the lawsuit, and if I remember right, you know, got like $100,000 settlement or something, like $100,000 in 1909. That's a lot of money, you know. And this wasn't the only thing that came along, you know, as far as a deceptive kind of thing. And so you would think, wouldn't you, that that would put someone out of business? Oh, no. I mean, his movement continued. And even after he died, like I said, Russell did not really start the Jehovah's Witnesses. That was in 1931 that became fully organized. He was already dead, you know. But still, most people would tie him into the beginning of that. And I thought for a while, it's like, how in the world could someone like that be able to propagate a religion? Why would anybody listen to them when he's been proven to be a fraud on these other things? Well, what's different today? I mean, you got some of these religious leaders today, you know, that have just been scoundrels in so many ways, as far as deceiving people, taking money from little old ladies, and, you know, to build their mansions and you know, just, I mean, things like this, infidelity, and yet people keep sending them money. And so it's like, you know, Ernest Angley and Copeland and Swaggart and some of these guys today, and they've got nothing on Russell back in the early 1900s. You know, in fact, maybe they read his book and that's where they got the ideas. I don't know.
Yeah. But he couldn't have told the followers. Well, the problem wasn't the same followers.
Yeah, they didn't have faith. It's a faith issue. I mean, sure. I mean, you could hear that, couldn't you? Something like that, you know, coming out of that. But, I mean, wow. So it's like we see some of the fallacies with the very, you know, beginning of this movement, you know, and such like that. And yet, through the years, Jehovah's Witness has been one of the largest and fastest growing religious organizations. I mean, they are out there all the time, you know, banging on doors and fervent, you know, about their message. their message being, the end is at hand. And even after Russell and some who came after him, you know, made these predictions, you know, about the coming of the Lord. I mean, it's happening, you know, now kind of a thing. Like, Russell first predicted the return of Christ would occur in 1874. Well, best I can tell, that's not happened. You know, I mean, he didn't come. And so then the date was changed to 1914. And this, in the 1914, I mean, it was published in his, on the issues, the first issue of The Watchtower. Remember, he had a publication record called, what was that, the Zion Watchtower or something like that, whatever it was. But now there is formed the Watchtower Publishing Company, you know, and which still exists today. And so it was publicized in there, and, you know, 1914 was going to be the date of the coming of the Lord, and it received a lot of publicity, and it didn't come. In fact, some would say, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses as a group, again, they'll actually put the date on there as 1914, and there's something to be said on that, because that was when they really kind of got formed. But it was not officially organized Jehovah's Witnesses until 1931. So that's why I ran with that date right there. And so, wow. I mean, here again, just like we've seen of some others, you know, who are supposed to be prophets of God and supposed to have some special insight and led by the Spirit of God, who make these kind of predictions, you know, that don't come true. You'd think they would just kind of fizzle and fade off into the sunset. But no, that whole movement has continued forth in a powerful and strong way. And you just think, how does that happen? Well, there's some other things here we can talk about for just a little bit. Lord willing, on Wednesday night, we'll talk a little bit more on some things that you see on page 82 and 83 in your outline. And we'll make just a few points. And again, as I said Wednesday night, you know, some of these movements, SDA, Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, Church of Christ Science, that we talked about in just a few minutes, we're not going deep into their doctrine as we did some of the other movements early on. We're kind of rolling this part up here because we're going to move into another period of time, something else that's already happening now in this period of time, late 1800s, the Restoration. That's really getting wound up. That's where we're headed to. And so after we talk a little bit more about Jehovah's Witnesses, we talk a little bit about the Holiness Movement, then we're moving right into the Restoration Movement. And so that's where our studies are going. Thank you for being here this morning. So glad you're here.